Alexander B. Wathen for the appellant, Mohammed Chowdhury. May it please the court, I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal.
All right, there you have the clock right there, and I'll also try to help you.
Thank you, Your Honor. This is of a case of a disabled veteran who served in the United States Armed Forces who has zero criminal history in the United States. The slight criminal history that involved in Australia was so far away that it goes beyond the one-year look-back period under the military naturalization statute. The only way that the government can claim relevancy is by using statements made during various immigration interviews in order to create a perception of misrepresentation and thereby render Mr. Chowdhury ineligible by claiming that he fails to have good moral character. The application for citizenship was filed on April 4th, 2004, so the only period of relevancy starts 1 year before that in April 2003 and, of course, does continue while the application's processed. Particularly, the government discusses, well, and its evidence has materials from interviews in 2008, 2009, and 2007. And, of course, Mr. Chowdhury, in his summary judgment evidence, indicated that he was subject to lengthy questioning in all of these and that he suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder, that he's had nightmares and medications, and also generally that he may have memory lapses or been mistaken. And he went into quite detail of that. I would not necessarily call this conclusory. In addition, for the 2007 interview, the May 30th or 31st, 2007, when Mr. Chowdhury puts in his statements and declarations that he was subject to duress.
When was the first time he brought up that somehow he couldn't be held accountable for his interviews because his memory was so bad he couldn't remember what he remembered?
You know, Your Honor, I don't recall exactly the first time. It would have certainly been at the very latest in the district court since the application was denied administratively and it had to go to de novo review before the district court. I can find that
out.
Did he ever
make that statement during the time of the interviews, 2007, 2008, 2009?
I don't believe so, but I'm not sure.
Okay.
Of course, generally, when someone's interviewed, presumably either during the course of an application, or I think in this case, some of them may have been when he tried to re-enter the country and was detained by the Immigration and Customs, those don't really represent a person's best statement. Presumably, anyone who's detained is worried about it and is not in control of the environment, that would also...
Do you have any case that suggests we should throw it out for that reason?
No, in fact, I'm not arguing that the court should throw it out, but what I am arguing is that mm-hmm. is why it's an issue that depends on the credibility of the witnesses, and that's why it should
be... Let me ask you about one specific item that I think has to do with the use of other names. And it seems that there's no dispute of fact that he had used this other Zaid name on more than one occasion, I think in Australia and otherwise. And the statement that he filled out for naturalization based on military service was within this one-year period, and he said, no, he'd never used any other names. Can you speak to that and how that evidence should be evaluated?
I don't have all the record at my tip of my fingers, but there was one instance when there was a question about whether a form was checked or not by Mr. Chowdhury, whether a box was checked by Mr. Chowdhury or somebody else. I think there's evidence of a forensic handwriting expert, but I don't know for sure if that speaks to that particular thing. Now, regardless,
I think the checkbox had to do with the police reserve. This was specifically, he does not contest, as best I can tell, that he did attempt to enter Australia using the name Zahid Mian or something like that. And that's not something he disclosed during any of the interviews. His declaration submitted to the district court appears to suggest, not that he didn't do it, but that he didn't say anything about it during the interviews because he didn't remember it. And it's the same declaration that talks about, my memory's bad, I've got problems, I don't remember what happened last week. And I think it's something the district court alludes to in saying, well, to say that I don't remember, so I didn't do it, begins to sound like speculation. He's not remembering that he did not disclose that, that he made a statement which he acknowledges to be false because he didn't remember the prior episode. But can you have, or did he profess to have, an affirmative memory of not saying because he didn't remember at that time? Or is he simply saying, well, that was then and this is now, and okay, I said something false at the time, but that's because I didn't remember. And is that testimony? Can you say, well, I must not have remembered because I wouldn't have been dishonest, which appears to be what his declaration says?
I think what he's trying to say is that that was an honest mistake, and that's something only when you observe the demeanor of a witness on the witness stand. It's only then a fact finder can really decide whether to accept or reject those claims. And obviously that's one of the most troubling aspects of the case for Mr. Chowdhury, is the issue of the name. But that's something that the district court should have held a trial to determine. They may have believed him, they may have not. But at the very least, Mr. Chowdhury's entitled to have a district court weigh his credibility and decide whether they accept it. That just can't be decided on paper. And that's the best argument I can make in response to that.
Well, and the thing is that this form that he filled out April 4th, 2004, about he'd never used any other names, he says no. When he's talked about, have you ever been arrested, that's when he does say he had this fraud conviction, and then he makes a little statement, which I would call an explanation of that. And he signed that, so I'm having some trouble in light of that, how a post-declaration, you know, some 7-8 years later, can undo that when his declaration doesn't really speak to that.
Well, it doesn't have it in great detail. I would imagine that any form, a person who's not a professional in any field fills it out as best they can. But of course, he wasn't trying to hide his what happened. But Mr. Chowdhury's understanding was that he was not put in prison. He didn't think he was convicted. He didn't quite understand what it means when you're not punished. And I think that has to be determined by a fact finder if his understanding is credible.
Well, it doesn't say. He says, well, I haven't used somebody else's identity. That's not the question. The question is, do you ever use another name? And the fact is, that seems undisputed. So that's where, you know, I'm just trying to understand. I'm very sympathetic to his explanation. I'm just trying to understand how it fits with the evidence. So what do we do with the fact that it seems undisputed that he did use another name, and that was repeated on more than one form, and that was one of the bases that the USCIS used? So maybe you can tell me where I go from there to his affidavit or elsewhere on his behalf.
I could submit a Rule 28 letter with some more detailed references if that's
desired. Well, no, I mean, if it's not in his affidavit, then we're pretty well stuck with the evidence, as you know, and I appreciate, as his pro bono lawyer, you're also stuck with the evidence. It's not like you could go in and help shape his argument. I'm not saying you would shape the facts, but you couldn't shape his argument at the outset. I understand that. Let me ask you this. If it's determined that there's no question of fact, really, with respect to use of another name. Is there any other basis to overturn the district court's order?
Well, I think that with respect to that, it would have to be with a specific intent I think there's some argument whether that rises to specific intent. There is another basis, too, though, and I'd like to cover that in a moment. I was recently made aware of an additional base. The ACLU of Southern California has filed a lawsuit that applications for naturalization by people from Muslim countries, such as Pakistan, even though Mr. Chowdhury is not a Muslim himself, he's from Pakistan, that those were delayed. And he may, and I'm considering submitting a Rule 28J letter on that he may be entitled to have discovery of whether his application was unduly delayed or he was targeted for that. Of course, at this point, it's premature to say that if he was specifically impacted, but that would be an additional basis to reverse, to allow him to do that, even though I think that the existing basis regarding genuine issue of material fact are so good alone that I wouldn't want to spend too much time on that lawsuit. But I think that's an additional basis just to make sure that the justice system produces the best possible outcome. That's a prudent thing to do, to remand, to allow that type of discovery. To see.
Do you want to save the remaining time?
Oh, I would, please.
All right.
May it please the Court, Your Honors. Craig Defoe here for the United States Government, the appellees in this case. Your Honors, in the words of the District Court, a disturbing pattern of deceit for immigration-related purposes permeates this case. The undisputed evidence support that, and I ask this Court to affirm the District Court's grant of summary judgment in favor of the government on Mr. Chowdhury's naturalization claim, because the evidence shows that he cannot establish the good moral character necessary to become a United States citizen. Your Honors are correct. There is no factual dispute that Mr. Chowdhury, on three separate occasions, gave false testimony when he denied having used any other names. And that's really the key to the case, the key to finding that he lacks good moral character. But the only question here is whether or not Mr. Chowdhury had the state of mind necessary, which is to say that whether or not he gave that false testimony deliberately and with the intent to gain immigration benefits. And I would suggest that the circumstantial evidence surrounding that false testimony establishes that there is only one reasonable conclusion to draw, which is that Mr. Chowdhury gave that false testimony deliberately and with the intent to gain immigration benefits. And to really understand all the circumstances, I think one of the most important points is that this is not an isolated incident of Mr. Chowdhury giving false information to the United States government or even to the Australian government.
I had a question about that. We have to go back 1 year from his application to, is it to 2004? Is that the beginning year or three? April 2003.
Exactly.
That's the 1 year beginning time. In your view, can you use any information before that time to establish intent, or does everything have to be from that date forward?
Absolutely, you can use information before that time to establish the context and the circumstances of the testimony that occurred within the period. So that's clear from the regulation and also the statute, and this Court has addressed that before in, I think, Santa Maria Ames is a case in which it's a very similar circumstance, where as long as the events that occurred prior to the period bear on what happens and what happened in the period, then the Court is free to consider all of the previous events and actions of the defendant in that.
Well, you can consider them, but if it's the same misrepresentation and he says, for example, with the name, he's misunderstanding. He's thinking nickname or identity but not actual name. Does that raise a factual issue given his claimed stress that he's talking about?
It does not, Your Honor, because the key question here is what was Mr. Chowdhury's state of mind at these interviews in 2007, 2008, and 2009? Now, he submitted the declaration where, as Your Honor mentioned, he claims at the point in time when he gave the declaration that, oh, this question made me think of nicknames and what people call me. Well, the issue isn't what Mr. Chowdhury thinks the question means at the time he gave this declaration. The issue is what was his state of mind at the time he gave the false testimony at these interviews. And if you look at the interviews, two of them there's video recordings of, and we have essentially a transcript of two of them as well, and documentary evidence of the third. He unequivocally denies ever having used any other names. There's no confusion in his answers. There's no suggestion that he might not remember having used another name. And so when you look at his unequivocal testimony there, that obviously lends support to the fact that this was intentional and deliberate false testimony.
And which interview, which date are you looking at?
Well, there's three separate interviews that are at issue.
Well, those are the 7, 8, and 9 interviews?
Exactly.
Yeah. So my question then is, he says, look, I went into the military. I never got to go to Iraq because I had this terrible back situation, end up in a wheelchair. I take all these medications. So I'm not in a state of mind where I could have done it willingly or knowingly. And then the question becomes, is that enough to raise an issue of fact? Now, I realize if this went back, of course, it would go back before the same judge. But leaving that aside, is there enough to raise an issue of fact?
That is not enough to raise an issue of fact because, again, these explanations and excuses that we've gotten from Mr. Chowdhury, they've come after the fact. He's offered speculation and these post hoc rationalizations for why he must have been innocently providing false testimony. But he also admits that his memory is terrible in that declaration. He says he can barely remember what happened the week before, much less years prior. And so that suggests that Mr. Chowdhury couldn't have created a genuine issue of material fact here. And there's also another key factor worth noting, is that on each of these occasions, the 2007, the 2008, the 2009 interviews, Mr. Chowdhury doesn't make excuses for this question for lack of memory. And in fact, he testifies at length regarding events that occurred well before the Zahid Mian fraudulent passport incident. He testified regarding his 1996 fraud convictions in Australia, and he offers a variety of different excuses as to why he didn't commit those fraud crimes and as to why he pled guilty, even though he didn't allegedly know what pleading guilty meant. But that shows that these claims of faulty memory are really too convenient to be believable. When we have in the interview, it shows that he has the memory to make excuses about the things that he was confronted on. The key to the Zahid Mian passport incident is that the immigration authorities didn't even know that that incident occurred during these interviews, so they weren't able to press him on it. We learned about that in discovery, and obviously the documentary evidence proves it beyond a doubt, and there's no dispute that in August of 2000, Mr. Chowdhury used this fraudulent Zahid Mian passport to attempt to enter Australia. He was caught. He was detained for about a week. He was questioned. He eventually admitted to his true identity, and that led to his permanent departure from Australia. So this was a significant incident. This is not the sort of thing that you would easily forget. He was in detention for around a week in Australia, and then about 2 weeks later, that's when he came to the United States for the first time. And it's worth noting that when the way Mr. Chaudhry was able to come to the United States was through two separate visa applications that were granted. But Mr. Chaudhry provided false information on those visa applications. He never disclosed those fraud crimes in Australia, and that's how he's able to get those granted. When he came here, he was here on a tourist visa, but despite not having work authorization, evidence shows that he started working without authorization.
Now, all of this happened before April 2003, is that correct?
That's correct. These events that I'm discussing.
And you started by quoting accurately, I think, from what the district court said, reflecting a disturbing pattern of deceit or something like that. My question is, all of this sounds like a general assessment of Mr. Chaudhry's credibility, but can a trier of fact make that kind of assessment on summary judgment before the Mr. Chaudhry, in this case, the applicant, has had an opportunity to testify and try to demonstrate to the court that he's credible?
Your Honor, I wouldn't characterize this as an assessment of credibility. I would say this is an assessment of the circumstances surrounding the false testimony to see whether or not there is a reasonable inference to be drawn in Mr. Chaudhry's favor. And the circumstances show that there is no reasonable inference to be made. And that's exactly what the district court found. So that's part of the reason why it's perfectly lawful for the court to look at the entire set of circumstances, which includes the entire period of time during which Mr. Chaudhry has been seeking immigration benefits in the United States. We know that his repeated provision of false information really bears a great amount of consideration here when evaluating whether or not he might have had an innocent state of mind. So I think that's a key factor, and that's what the
district court said. That sounds to me like a statement that says the court has decided this person's not credible. He's got this pattern, so whatever excuse he comes up with now, I'm really not prepared to listen to because I don't believe it. Isn't that a credibility assessment?
Again, Your Honor, I wouldn't characterize it as a credibility assessment. In fact, this is very similar, if not sort of an identical situation, as to what the Ninth Circuit considered in FEC versus Toledano. In that case, as here, the judge was the trier of fact. In that case, as here, there was a question as to whether or not the defendant had adequately created a genuine issue of material fact regarding his state of mind.
Is that the campaign finance case?
Yes. Okay. Yes. In that case, the district court ruled without a trial and found that the circumstantial evidence, and the Ninth Circuit affirmed, finding that circumstantial evidence was key to determining whether or not there was a genuine issue of material fact. And ultimately, the Ninth Circuit affirmed the grant of summary judgment, despite the fact that the defendant there, as Mr. Chaudhry has here, has claimed memory lapses and, in the words of the Ninth Circuit, conclusory protestations of innocence. That's exactly what we have here. We have these conclusory excuses for Mr. Chaudhry to try to explain away his false testimony, and we have these convenient memory lapses which he claims occurred at the time. And so following what the Ninth Circuit did in FEC versus Toledano, I think that's this case falls exactly within that line of cases. And in fact, there's another additional point worth noting here, which is that the substantive evidentiary standard is relevant here. The burden is on Mr. Chaudhry to prove good moral character by clear and convincing evidence because he's seeking naturalization. The Supreme Court held in Anderson v. Liberty Lobby that when evaluating summary judgment, the substantive evidentiary standard is something that's relevant and to be taken account of here. So given the fact that this is not a mere preponderance case, Mr. Chaudhry has an even greater burden, which is clear and convincing evidence. That shows that summary judgment is even more appropriate here. And Briefly, to address what opposing counsel mentioned, there's no reason to remand this case for discovery into the allegations that may be found in a completely separate case. This is a de novo proceeding. Mr. Chaudhry had the de novo proceeding in district court, and this is his appeal from that case. And so there's absolutely no basis to remand for discovery into speculative claims that he never has once made in this case. If Your Honors don't have any other questions.
It appears not. Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, with respect to the Toledano case, I think that the proposition that that can be said to stand for best described as lack of memory is not sufficient to withstand summary judgment to negate lack of bad faith. And we have here is a little bit different situation where there were statements initially made, and in this case the declarant, Mr. Chaudhry, is indicating that, you know, the lack of memory and the other issues that goes to whether I was mistaken there, it's not simply the situation in Toledano where it says I can't remember, therefore I cannot have bad faith. And that I think is the most significant difference I can see with the Toledano.
Okay, I'm having a little trouble understanding the difference.
Well, essentially Mr. Chaudhry is in a way trying to impeach his own statements. And of course the U.S. Supreme Court in the Cungus case indicated that false testimony is limited to oral statements, but to the extent these are oral statements, then Mr. Chaudhry is essentially, in a sense, he's impeaching himself, but he's saying, well, at the time I was mistaken, or I was under duress, or the other circumstances, so what I said was I was susceptible to making mistakes. And it's also reasonable to argue that lack of memory doesn't mean you don't remember anything past a certain date. Typically, it's very possible that lack of memory comes out different in different things, and maybe somebody who's functional would presumably remember most things happen, but may not remember everything, and certainly may not remember in certain settings. And these are things
The court said in Toledano that the district court was entitled to draw negative inferences about the state of mind based on the suspicious memory lapses and the undisputed evidence presented by the government. So Toledano suggests that you can do that in a summary judgment context.
I think maybe that's a case of bad facts makes bad law, since all the inferences have to be drawn in Mr. Chowdhury's favor. So
Well, that was a summary judgment case also.
That's one of the problems, but the best argument I can come up with is that, well, there are negative inferences that can be drawn, but since the court is required to draw the most favorable inferences to Mr. Chaudhry, that would create a genuine issue of material fact, even if the negative ones are drawn as well. So I think that is exactly what a genuine issue of material fact is, when there are various and more than one inference that can be drawn from testimony. I see that I'm a little bit short of time. I hope that answers your question.
It does. Thank you very much.
Judge. I think also that the Santa Maria Ames case is somewhat distinguishable, and that involves a number of criminal convictions in the United States, a long criminal record. One of the reasons for the one-year look-back period only would presumably be that Congress and the federal government believes that military service changes people's lives and it builds character, and that past events should be de-emphasized. And if the government is allowed to import all the past things, then it obviously it I see that my time is up, but if the government were to be allowed to import the past things and get around that, that would defeat the purpose. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. The case just argued, Chaudhry v. Napolitano, is submitted. I would like to thank you, Mr. Walton, for your participation in the court's pro bono program. It's very helpful to the court to have organized briefing on these issues. I know that the Department of Justice also appreciates that, and we appreciate your coming, Mr. Defoe, and your argument this morning. The case is submitted. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.